Nigel, you're unusual in that your original degree was in philosophy and psychology, and yet now you're best known for your work in tech and in artificial intelligence. How did that pathway work for you? Because it strikes a lot of people as unusual, someone who was a philosopher and a psychologist moving towards computer technology.
Well, I guess I was always taken with the scientific disciplines, you know, my A-levels at school were in that area. But I was always really fascinated by the question of what constituted the basis of human intelligence, what made us the way we were, how could I be sat here having first-person experiences of the external world and presuming that other people had the same thing, you know, what gave rise to this sense of self? And those questions in the late 70s were really the province of philosophers of mind, and also cognitive science. So I thought that was a really interesting undergraduate degree to read for. And in the course of that degree, became more aware of artificial intelligence, which, of course, even in the late 70s, it had been around for 20, 30 years, depending on where you take its history from, and rapidly realized that what I really would like to do would be a PhD in artificial intelligence, in cognitive science. And I went up to Edinburgh in 1978 to begin my studies there. So I was always taken with the question of how far formal methods could actually help us understand the basis of our own intelligence. And I think that was a very good place to start with some of those broader philosophical questions.
Right. Now, take us through what's happened in the area of applied artificial intelligence in the last 3 months, because we've now become aware that it's being used in tracking and tracing people who have become infected with the virus. But it's gone to kind of greater lengths, hasn't it, in Asia, specifically in South Korea and China. So just kind of run us through what's been going on and what the contribution has been really since this began in February, March.
Well, I think to understand artificial intelligence's contribution here, you've got to wind back a little bit. I mean, periodically, on about every 10 years or so, AI becomes the new technology that's going to disrupt and change everything. And for some time now, for a few years, people have been looking at AI, the new generation of machine learning in AI, so-called deep neural networks. And they've taken us further, along with the earlier techniques, which sit there in our technique set. We've now got these new powerful machine learning methods. They've been used to beat the world's best Go player. They've been used to achieve some remarkable outcomes in terms of face recognition, in terms of language understanding, analysis, translation. These new techniques plus the existing methods now give us a big toolbox, and people got very excited about where AI would take us. And of course, people would say, well, in this new context, you know, how can you use these methods? I always like to point out that AI is a spectrum of techniques. You know, where does traditional computing end and AI take over? And an awful lot of AI, when you look under the bonnet, it turns out to be very familiar statistical analysis, very familiar forms of looking for patterns. And I think that looking for patterns, of course, is exactly what people have been concerned to think about in the pandemic context. So, I mean, before we get onto contact and trace, one area that's being very actively looked at is trying to examine a very broad range of existing drugs for potential benefit in treating the symptoms. And again, AI drug discovery, AI analysis of drugs and their potential properties to help has been just one area where AI has been very, very, very effectively deployed. I think in track and trace, the whole idea of contact tracing, the general problem there is, how do I work out the various contacts in which I've actually had through a day, through a week? You can represent those contacts formally in this thing we call a graph. It's a set, you know, all in the graph there are these nodes which represent individuals, and links between individuals represent the fact you've met somebody. Now, that's a very familiar form of representing and reasoning in AI and actually in mathematics generally. These graph analyses methods, you can do a lot of analysis to work out who's met where, who where, are there clusters of particular contacts, do they have particular characteristics in common? At the simplest level, you might just want to know who has literally been in close proximity with someone else. You might not need to know where, or indeed for how long necessarily, or indeed to reveal the identity of that individual, but you want to know that that actual contact in some way that you can specify happened. And these methods are the meat and drink of a lot of AI analysis.
So what is going on at the moment in countries like China and South Korea that disconcerts people, and to what extent is the government and the NHS in this country using sort of similar techniques at the moment when it comes to sort of tracing individuals?
Well, bearing in mind that, as I say, these methods are part general computer science, and where, you know, AI methods are used, it's often, as I say, just a continuation of computing by other means. What you will see in some countries, it's not just the contact tracing app that's being used. So they will use other technologies and techniques in association with the contact tracing. And clearly in China, they were using facial recognition. They were using just straightforward drone technology to keep an eye on whether people were actually in public spaces and places. They were using other forms of electronic identification, from payment transactions to identity cards, to essentially build up a picture of who was where, when. Now, that complete form of surveillance is something that some legislations and some jurisdictions, some countries will be able to stand up very quickly and content to do that. And I think you will see different blends of those methods and techniques in different countries. Some people rely much more heavily on existing electronic medical records that are linked to individuals, and they can then link that back into things like contact tracing apps. That's the case, for example, in Singapore. In Korea, again, there's a different mix. When you arrive in the UK, you might say, "Well, what do we have? What ingredients do we have?" And truth is that we have always had quite a, quite a fragmented information space. For various reasons, we've kept our medical information distinct, managed in particular sorts of ways, not always connecting across the piece. We've always had a view that, whilst there is a lot of actual video surveillance in the UK, it isn't necessarily joined together. We're not using routine facial identification at scale in the country. And I'm not sure people would want that necessarily. But there are these different components in the jigsaw that people have been able to put together. And different countries have come up with different solutions to this challenge.
In the NHS, they have tried, haven't they, historically, to kind of bring that data together, more than a decade ago, but it didn't work, did it?
No, it was quite a challenge. I mean, these very large IT projects, often commissioned within government, don't have always the greatest record. Having said that, there's nothing like the urgency, the disruption caused by a situation like this to move things on. And I think that one thing that's very interesting is the extent to which data from the existing detailed electronic medical records, which are provided by private companies, actually, who offer the medical record technology, a number of these have gotten together, and people have begun to look at how you can interrogate these sets of patient records, actually using pretty good security and very good security around not revealing the underlying details of patient information. You can do analysis to find the patterns without actually having to pull all the detailed personal information off the central servers. And this actually has been something that we've seen some real progress on, I would suggest. it's taken a lot of time and effort to, historically, we've had lots of challenges in doing that, but this is a situation where people have made real efforts to pool that information.
Right. So, I mean, I get the sense that you're broadly in favour of it, but when there have been examples there where there was the very high profile thing with DeepMind, wasn't there, in the Royal Free in London, why does that sort of stir things up to the extent that it does and upset so many people, if indeed it does do that?
Well, it's about transparency and accountability and consent, I think. Look, in this situation I've just described, that data is still resident behind the NHS firewalls in a certain sense. It's not been exported to a third-party commercial interest. One would imagine that there'd be very broad-based consent to have information shared in that kind of way for medical analysis by approved data scientists within the NHS community. When people do get concerned, it's when apparently data is used in ways that seem to go beyond that presumption that it's a public good for a public task. And again, I think that, yes, I am broadly in favour, but I'm in favour where the governance is very clear and the rules and limitations and the purposes for which that data is being used are very clear.
Okay. So it's interesting, when one reads about your subject, it's clearly emerging the whole time, and as the technology advances, things change. But the example that's often used is almost like a gold standard of where government in this country did a reasonably good job was the Warnock report and the Human Fertilization and Embryology bill, and now the organization that regulates that. So what stage are we at in the development of AI and regulation in this country at the moment? What would you like to see, and to what extent can that regulation be of necessity shared across national boundaries? Because after all, as we've seen, you know, with this pandemic, this is an international thing, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. And the Warnock Commission is a very good example. This, of course, was around human embryology and fertilization. And this deep thinking, actually chaired by an ethical philosopher, actually, who brought together very many different stakeholders in advance of all of the technology being delivered, but aware that this was moving very fast, to work out what the rules could be for how and when certain sorts of very sensitive tissue and interventions could be made in the area of human embryology. And it's widely regarded that that was a success indeed, and that it gave the chance for the UK to do really pioneering research in this area. So I think, to your point, the issue about effective regulation, people always think of regulation as just the burden of regulation. Often that's what we talk about. But very often, thought of in the right way, it can be a key to enabling innovation to flourish in a way that has the consent of the wider public and society. And I think with AI, we're beginning to see that conversation emerge. And I think we will see it emerge with ever greater speed as we see the opportunities and also the challenges of this technology. Regulators, whether it's the Information Commissioner, whether it is the whether it's Ofcom, whether it's the regulators for competition and markets, they're looking at this and saying, you know, do the new AI platforms, do the new methods and techniques give us the degree of accountability and transparency we need? And just one good example of that is all the data that we know is being shipped off our mobile phones, our smartphones each day as we use all these wonderful apps. People say the deal is you give up your data in return for these services. Actually, where is that data going? How much concentration is there of that data within just a few core platforms and intermediaries? And is that something that we would need to regulate so that we don't build distorted markets? I mean, just an economic reason. But then, of course, there's the question around social equity and fairness,
yeah,
too.
But what, I mean, for an organization like Facebook, what attention do they need to pay to regulation in this country and in Europe? Because the perception, certainly from the States, is that Brussels is kind of loaded against American big tech and will do any, you know, anything it can to sort of hobble it. How is that going to be able to work? Is it likely that it will have to be done on an individual country by country basis, and they'll just have to comply, you know, on that basis?
Well, of course, you know, the big platforms would love to adopt the great maxim of build it once and deploy everywhere, but actually, that isn't going to work. You know, in a world with different jurisdictions with different views about what isn't permissible, you may well end up with a number of very, very particular blocks where the experience and the regulation will be shared. And it's likely that the UK will still, for example, remain under the general GDPR, the General Data Protection Regulation framework, so that I can imagine that it won't just be country by country. There could be some very broad settlements on some of these questions. And some countries may take a particular view on particular platforms, and they clearly have. And we can see this with the fines and the ICO recently levied on a number of the platforms. So I think these platforms do have to be aware of the limits and boundaries. And I think that effective governance has to work out where it is important to try and control and understand the benefits, but also the harms that are potentially inherent in this technology. And the UK is actually thinking pretty hard about this. There are before the pandemic, there were white papers on exactly this, online harms and various forms of regulation that might need to be put around the platforms, such that clearly it's very difficult for a very dominant player in this field to simply say, oh, trust us, we can regulate ourselves. It's got to be the case that it is part of the warp and weft of our societies that we have regulators that sit and ensure that we have equitable, fair, but also efficient methods of using services.
I mean, it's interesting, isn't it, that often all the big US tech companies are loaded together, but I would have thought that an organization like Apple has a very different attitude towards data and privacy and the collective good than something like Facebook does, don't they?
I think different companies will have their own, almost their own DNA on this, almost their own history. They'll also have different amounts of incumbent position or advantage that they might seek to protect or enhance. So, yeah, I think that's right. And I think you will also see areas where the companies see that it's in their interest to also to collaborate. So there are a number of the big tech giants, Apple, Google, Microsoft, in the data transfer project, which was a way of enabling standards to exist that allowed personal information to be easily moved from one platform to another at the user's behest, you know, for the user's benefit. So I think it's all about looking at these new ecosystems, looking at the general data environment, and working out what maximizes the potential benefits for the widest number of stakeholders there.
Now, tell us then what you sought to achieve when you founded the Open Data Institute, which is more than 10 years ago now, and what you feel that you've managed to achieve in that decade.
Well, actually, just under a decade, but there we go. It is something that both Tim Berners-Lee and I felt very strongly was that as governments were releasing more and more of the data that they collected, that they had available, the non-personal data about everything from when the trains ran to what the pollution levels in our rivers were, or indeed our basic mapping information, as they released more and more of this, you had this foundation of open data. And we were keen to make that as broad a foundation, encompassing as much as possible. We often talk in the Open Data Institute, the ODI, of data as infrastructure, a bit like your railways and roads and electricity grid, that this is something that needs to be invested in, worked on to particular standards of quality, interoperability and the rest. And the UK got off to a really strong start in this area. It was certainly, in many respects, leading the world in open data releases. In that intervening period of time, the Open Data Institute, we recognize that data just doesn't come in one type. It's a whole spectrum from open to shared to private data to closed data. And we work across that spectrum now because you need to work out how your open data is a foundational element on which other kinds of data sit and derive value. It isn't just about government data as well. It's about persuading and working with private companies to show them that some of their data assets have much greater value made openly available than locked in a silo where they imagine they might be able to do something with it one day. And so that's been a very interesting evolution of our thinking and work.
But why would Tesco let other people look at the data from their club card? I mean, they're the most pertinent example, aren't they? They were the first of the sort of, you know, big retailers on that realised the value of it. I mean, why would it be in Tesco's interest to let Sainsbury's or Waitrose, you know, have a look at the data it has on its customers?
Probably not that example. Although, of course, the interesting thing about the club card is that the people who don't have an interest in it are the customers. So the relationship between my data, the transactions I have with all of my retail world have two interested parties, the consumer and the provider. And so there's a piece of work to do there, and we've been working on that around the ability to get that data back into the hands of the consumer, who can then have it repurposed in various ways to their end. But certainly when you come to the issue of sharing data, it isn't all about the detailed transactions, but it might be about everything from the information you have about your stock or how you describe it or the fact of where it's originated from or standard ways to compare and contrast the actual food contents on their health attributes of the various products you're selling off the shelves. There's ways in which you might share profitably aspects of the logistics supply chain. There are always areas where data assets have wider value to companies in a sector when shared. Not all of it, but certainly big chunks of it. So trying to get organizations and companies on a journey where their first instinct isn't just to hug everything they've got, this kind of notion of data hugging, but to imagine that some of it may really help provide a better context for all operators and their supply chain contributors to work in.
Okay. Tell us what data trust is.
Data trust. Well, this is this interesting idea that we've been working on. And it's an idea that's come through, which is to understand that sometimes when we think about the way we've arrived into the kind of world we now live with these extraordinary platforms, with their products and services, it's all about the technology. And there is certainly a huge amount about getting those architectures right, those technical architectures right. But there's also, you can think of it in terms of, we sometimes describe this as an institutional architecture. So the kind of structures that exist, if you think about historically the cooperatives and the mutuals that existed with groups of interested members who had joint interest around, well, I think sometimes it was around their savings, it was around the actual issues of the day, labor relations, whatever. Those structures can form an interesting way to think about how you might want to bring groups together who have data assets. So a data mutual might be a bunch of individuals who have a shared interest in pooling their information. A data trust takes us a stage further to think about the idea of, if we were to put our data into a trust structure, it would have some of the notions of a legal structure with a clear purpose, rights and duties over stewarded data, defined way of making decisions about how you use that data, and a description of how the benefits are shared. Why wouldn't you think about setting up explicit legal structures to manage the data for the greatest benefit of its members. And this is something that we think has a really exciting potential role to play in making a healthy data environment.
Has it started yet? Do such things exist?
They're beginning to be set up. I mean, people are beginning to understand how you might establish these trusts. And there are one or two notable examples where I think you can pretty well say this is a data trust. So Open Corporates, a very well-known company which pulls together the world's information around legal companies and their relationships to one another, and their details of who owns them, who has the shares in them, and so on. They've established a data trust essentially for the core data that underpins that company. So we think that these are really compelling examples. You can begin to see it, I think, emerging in the health sector, where you've got various organizations who would wish to share their data on a trust-based mechanism. This is, I would say, an area where you'll see a lot of development over the next couple of years.
Okay. Now, the other side of the trust thing was the subject of some research that you did with YouGov, wasn't it, at the ODI, where you were looking at the levels of trust that the general population felt as far as its sort of data was concerned. And the results weren't great, were they? I mean, I think it was 31% of the people that you polled felt that they trusted government with their personal information. And when it came to businesses, the numbers were even lower. I mean, what do you think the reason for that is?
I think there's partly an atmosphere effect as well around the issue that people do not feel empowered or in control of their data. Somebody else is always doing stuff they feel to their information, their data, and they don't feel enfranchised or empowered in any real sense. I think that's often where issues of trust arise. You'll recall that study did show that one of the most trusted institutions was, in fact, the NHS, interestingly enough. And I think that's partly because people have a clearer sense of the purpose and the reasons for information being held and why they might be held. Now, I think there's a real opportunity in a disruptive event like this to reset the rules and expectations around trust in data. It will be important, whatever we do through the pandemic, that it's consultative and that where particular information sharing is allowed and enabled for public health reasons, that is capable of being rolled back if necessary. If people are not comfortable, that you can sunset some of these relationships. Now, again, it would need to be shown where the benefits are in these contexts. And if people see very, very clear public health benefits, one can see these sorts of sharing arrangements remaining. But I have to say that our people's trust in institutions has been one of the casualties over the last decade or so. And it is about, I think, re-establishing very clear guidelines and being transparent and accountable around the information that's collected and for what purpose. When these things go into effective organizational black boxes and then are put into black boxes that we might think of as AI analytics, it's kind of a double challenge.
Mm. But don't you think it's pretty extraordinary that a guy like me in my 50s, so I go for my annual bloods at my local GP to check my cholesterol and all the rest of it, my GP won't even email me the answers with them. You know, I have to either go in there or at least before March or be told them over the phone. I mean,
well, it is in a way just daft, I have to say. And I think one of the consequences of this move to remote interaction, and talking to my colleagues who work in medicine, they're saying that they're simply having to move to different modes of information exchange. And of course, there are issues around security and making sure the right information goes to the right place. But this is exactly what you should be able to expect. You should have an absolute confident, secure route into your information. You've got it, you're beginning to see it for some aspects of your government life, whether it's HMRC or whatever. Look, it has to be the case that we're capable of having a much richer exchange of our essential information about our health and well-being. And it's not just health data, it's social care data, it's a whole range of data, it's your educational data. There is so much friction still in the system.
Surely there's an argument, isn't there, a libertarian argument, that we ought to be able to make our own decisions about, you know, whether we want to sort of, you know, buy statins or have them prescribed for us or whatever. And it seems to me there's a particular kind of strong resistance, isn't there, in this country that does come, one feels, slightly from that, you know, cradle to the grave thing where we've got this, particularly when it comes to health, a kind of rather paternalistic state, and the sense is that, you know, that they make all the kind of decisions on our behalf. Whereas these days, you know, with people with Fitbits and everything, there are many people out there who want to have control of those sorts of things, aren't there?
And I think not unreasonably. And I think that, again, the fact that you should be empowered with your data and not either kept remote from it or oppressed by it is exactly why the ODI is there discussing these sorts of issues, and why I still feel there's so much work to be done from a policy and a regulation point of view. And back to the Warnock Commission, it was all about trying to give forms of agency and decision-making back to the individual citizen. You know, in this case, it was about effective treatment for people who were in a really unfortunate position in their lives. Why shouldn't that be more generally available? Now, the flip side of that will be, as we get more and more powerful methods of insight from modern precision medicine, from modern AI, the question then comes, your information isn't necessarily just your information. And take the very interesting example of genomic analysis. Your genome is not just your genome. It is the joint genome of your children, your children's children, and those to whom you're related. And there are really interesting questions about spillover from these forms of data sharing practice. So we really do need to understand that space well.
But you have to be careful, don't you? I was talking to a friend on Friday who she's a single mum with kids in year 6 at school, and she's separated. Her ex-husband has gone and got one of those 23andMe tests done, which has revealed, they say, something to do with, a blood clotting. But I mean, he's completely asymptomatic. He's never had any problems with that or what have you. But it's obviously put the frighteners on him to the extent that he's refused to allow his kids to go back to school today. And there is a problem, isn't there, with people having, you know, amounts of information and not being, you know, because they're not trained medics, not knowing what the clinical significance of something like that is. And so it can lead to problems, that, can't it, where people kind of run away with themselves, where they might be better actually sort of sitting down and discussing it with a genetics expert or whatever.
And that's a great example, isn't it? And it is this kind of relationship that you have with experts in the field to contextualize the information, to represent it back to you. And that is where we're going to be increasingly as we gain more and more insight about our biology, our psychology, our behavioral life patterns. We're going to be offered up all of this analysis, but we will need to understand that in context. And I think that is one of the real obligations on all of us who work in this space and commentate on it and write about it, is not to kind of offer up simple nostrums, simple solutions. We need to be aware of the wider questions of risk and insight, expertise and knowledge that allows us to make collectively and not just individually informed decisions.
Mm. And it is difficult, isn't it? Because never has the kind of the role of the expert been more under the microscope than it is at the moment with the SAGE committee. But it's very difficult, isn't it, for politicians to say that they don't know and they aren't sure.
That is a fascinating point. I think one of the
Bohr who said the definition of an expert is someone who's made mistakes in absolutely every single element of his area, his or her area of expertise. And it's a very difficult thing, that, isn't it? Because people think that science is about, you know, objectiveness and being sure about everything. But actually, if you talk to scientists, they're the least sure people you can ever come across.
Science is about... Science proceeds by always, this wonderful phrase used, standing on the edge of error, and that you are fundamentally in the position of being shown to be wrong about what you believe to be the case by the evidence from your experiment or from nature or whatever. Expertise, properly understood, is also about knowing the limits of what you actually understand about the world or about the situation you're in. That delimitation or circumscription, this I'm confident about, this I'm not. And in some areas, those are grey. I think one of the great tragedies of often of political discourse is you're not, in some sense, allowed or believe you can admit to simply not knowing. Not knowing, not being certain, is one of the most important cognitive states, because then you can have a much more interesting discussion of how would, what would we need to know to be more informed. And this kind of belief that scientists just know the answers to everything, it's not how science operates, and it's not how science is. And that's the same, of course, with the models that have been used to predict various aspects. We now very much aware that scientific expertise is under the microscope. But to be fair to everybody who are trying their level best, they never claim, ever claim in their papers to have an omniscient understanding of how these processes work. Mm.
And then in the end, you get the kind of extraordinary situation as the, you know, with the professor at Imperial, where it, you know, nobody in a million years could have thought, and, you know, an epidemiologist could end up being on the front page of the Daily Mail in the way in which he was.
And that is really a challenge, I think. And one has to understand, really, that in trying to provide advice under pressure, under imperfect knowledge, people have generally been using their very best efforts. And it's very easy with hindsight to think that the models might have been different, better. We might have had different sorts of information. I think what is crucial in all of this is the recognition that under unremitting power of data itself. And I think that it is really incumbent on us at this time to think, what is the kind of data infrastructure we require to answer these questions? What would we like to know? And of course, if you knew confidently what that contact graph was, who had symptoms, who didn't, who had the current disease, who had doesn't, who's had it in the past, your ability to manage, predict, and go forward is so much greater. So data is going to be the ultimate solution to many of the challenges we're facing here.
And do you think, finally, then, that's probably why the German statistics around morbidity and mortality with COVID have been apparently better than ours?
I think it's very striking to look at how really tight data acquired early on has made the difference. And you can see that same example in Korea and a number of places that seem to have managed it down. They've managed it with data.